Chapter 3. Doremus Jessup, editor and proprietor of the Daily Informer, the Bible of the conservative Vermont farmers up and down the Beulah Valley, was born in Fort Beulah in 1876, only son of an impecunious Universalist pastor, the Reverend Loren Jessup. His mother was no less than a Bass of Massachusetts. The Reverend Loren, a bookish man and fond of flowers, merry but not noticeably witty, used to chant, "Alas, alas, that a Bass of Mass should marry a minister prone to gas," and he would insist that she was all wrong ichthyologically. She should have been a cod, not a Bass. There was in the parsonage little meat but plenty of books, not all theological by any means, so that before he was 12 Doremus knew the profane writings of Scott, Dickens, Thackeray, Jane Austen, Tennyson, Byron, Keats, Shelley, Tolstoy, Balzac. He graduated from Isaiah College, once a bold Unitarian venture, but by 1894 an interdenominational outfit with nebulous Trinitarian yearnings, a small and rustic stable of learning in North Beulah, 13 miles from the fort. But Isaiah College has come up in the world today, excepting educationally, for in 1931 it held the Dartmouth football team down to 64-6. During college, Doremus wrote a great deal of bad poetry and became an incurable book addict, but he was a fair track athlete. Naturally, he corresponded for papers in Boston and Springfield, and after graduation he was a reporter in Rutland and Worcester, with one glorious year in Boston, whose grimy beauty and shards of the past were to him what London would be to a young Yorkshireman. He was excited by concerts, art galleries, and bookshops. Thrice a week he had a 25-cent seat in the upper balcony of some theater, and for 2 months he roomed with a fellow reporter who had actually had a short story in the Century, and who could talk about authors and technique like the very Dickens. But Doremus was not particularly beefy or enduring, and the noise, the traffic, the bustle of assignments exhausted him, and in 1901, 3 years after his graduation from college, when his widowed father died and left him $2,980 and his library, Doremus went home to Fort Beulah and bought a quarter interest in the Informer, then a weekly. By 1936 it was a daily, and he owned all of it, with a perceptible mortgage. He was an equable and sympathetic boss, an imaginative news detective. He was, even in this iron-bound Republican state, independent in politics, and in his editorials against graft and injustice, though they were not fanatically chronic, he could slash like a dog whip. He was a third cousin of Calvin Coolidge, who had considered him sound domestically but loose politically. Doremus considered himself just the opposite. He had married his wife Emma out of Fort Beulah. She was the daughter of a wagon manufacturer, a placid, prettyish, broad-shouldered girl with whom he had gone to high school. Now, in 1936, of their 3 children, Philip, Dartmouth and Harvard Law School, was married and ambitiously practicing law in Worcester. Mary was the wife of Fowler Greenhill, M.D. of Fort Beulah, a gay and hustling medico, a choleric and red-headed young man who was a wonder worker in typhoid, acute appendicitis, obstetrics, compound fractures, and diets for anemic children. Fowler and Mary had 1 son, Doremus's only grandchild, the bonny David, who at 8 was a timid, inventive, affectionate child with such mourning hound-dog eyes and such red-gold hair that his picture might well have been hung at a National Academy show or even been reproduced on the cover of a women's magazine with 2,500,000 circulation. The Greenhills' neighbors inevitably said of the boy, "My, Davy's got such an imagination, hasn't he? I guess he'll be a writer, just like his grandpa." 3rd of Doremus's children was the gay, the pert, the dancing Cecilia, known as Sissy, aged 18, where her brother Philip was 32 and Mary, Mrs. Greenhill, turned 30. She rejoiced the heart of Doremus by consenting to stay home while she was finishing high school, though she talked vigorously of going off to study architecture and simply make millions, my dear, by planning and directing miraculous small homes. Mrs. Jessop was lavishly and quite at her Philip was the spit and image of the Prince of Wales. Philip's wife, Marilla, the fair daughter of Worcester, Massachusetts, curiously like the Princess Marina, that Mary would by any stranger be taken for Catherine Hepburn, that Sissy was a dryad and David a medieval page, and that Doremus, though she knew him better than she did those changelings, her children, amazingly resembled that naval hero, Winfield Scott Sly, as he looked in 1898. She was a loyal woman, Emma Jessop, warmly generous, a cordon bleu at making lemon meringue pie, a parochial Tory, an orthodox Episcopalian, and completely innocent of any humor. Doremus was perpetually tickled by her kind solemnity, and it was to be chalked down to him as a singular act of grace that he refrained from pretending that he had become a working communist and was thinking of leaving for Moscow immediately. Doremus looked depressed, looked old, when he lifted himself as from an invalid's chair out of the Chrysler, in his hideous garage of cement and galvanized iron. But it was a proud two-car garage. Besides the four-year-old Chrysler, they had a new Ford convertible coupe, which Doremus hoped to drive some day when Sissy wasn't using it. He cursed competently as, on the cement walk from the garage to the kitchen, he barked his shins on the lawnmower, left there by his hired man, one Oscar Ledoux, known always as Shad, a large and red-faced, a sulky and surly Irish Canuck peasant. Shad always did things like leaving lawnmowers about to snap at the shins of decent people. He was entirely incompetent and vicious. He never edged up the flower beds. He kept his stinking old cap on his head when he brought in logs for the fireplace. He did not scythe the dandelions in the meadow till they had gone to seed. He delighted in failing to tell cook that the peas were now ripe, and he was given to shooting cats, stray dogs, chipmunks, and honey-voiced blackbirds. At least twice a day, Doremus resolved to fire him, but perhaps he was telling himself the truth when he insisted that it was amusing to try to civilize this prize bull. Doremus trotted into the kitchen, decided that he did not want some cold chicken and a glass of milk from the icebox, nor even a wedge of the celebrated coconut layer cake made by their cook general, Mrs. Candy, and mounted to his study on the third, the attic floor. His house was an ample, white, clapboarded structure of the vintage of 1880, a square bulk with a mansard roof and, in front, a long porch with insignificant square white pillars. Doremus declared that the house was ugly, but ugly in a nice way. His study up there was his one perfect refuge from annoyances and bustle. It was the only room in the house that Mrs. Candy, quiet, grimly competent, thoroughly literate, once a Vermont country school teacher, was never allowed to clean. It was an endearing mess of novels, copies of the Congressional Record, of the New Yorker, Time, Nation, New Republic, New Masses, and Speculum, cloistral organ of the medieval society, treatises on taxation and monetary systems, road maps, volumes on exploration in Abyssinia and the Antarctic, chewed stubs of pencils, a shaky portable typewriter, fishing tackle, rumpled carbon paper, two comfortable old leather chairs, a Windsor chair at his desk, the complete works of Thomas Jefferson, his chief hero, a microscope and a collection of Vermont butterflies, Indian arrowheads, exiguous volumes of Vermont village poetry printed in local newspaper offices, the Bible, the Quran, the Book of Mormon, Science and Health, selections from the Mahabharata, the poetry of Sandburg, Frost, Masters, Jeffers, Ogden Nash, Edgar Guest, Omar Khayyam, and Milton, a shotgun and a 22 repeating rifle, an Isaiah College banner, faded, the complete Oxford Dictionary, 5 fountain pens, of which 2 would work, a vase from Crete dating from 327 BC, very ugly, the World Almanac for a year before last, with the cover suggesting that it had been chewed by a dog, odd pairs of horn-rimmed spectacles and of rimless eyeglasses, none of which now suited his eyes, a fine, reputedly Tudor oak cabinet from Devonshire, portraits of Ethan Allen and Thaddeus Stevens, rubber wading boots, senile red Morocco slippers, a poster issued by the Vermont Mercury at Woodstock on September 2, 1840, announcing a glorious Whig victory, 24 boxes of safety matches, one by one stolen from the kitchen, assorted yellow scratch pads, 7 books on Russia and Bolshevism, extraordinarily pro or extraordinarily con, a signed photograph of Theodore Roosevelt, 6 cigarette cartons, all half empty. According to the tradition of journalistic eccentrics, Doremus should have smoked a good old pipe, but he detested the slimy ooze of nicotine-soaked spittle. A rag carpet on the floor, a withered sprig of holly with a silver Christmas ribbon, a case of 7 unused genuine Sheffield razors, dictionaries in French, German, Italian, and Spanish, the first of which languages he really could read, a canary in a Bavarian gilded wicker cage, a worn linen-bound copy of old hearthside songs for home and picnic, whose selections he was wont to croon, holding the book on his knee, and an old cast-iron Franklin stove. Everything, indeed, that was proper for a hermit and improper for impious domestic hands. Before switching on the light, he squinted through a dormer window at the bulk of mountains cutting the welter of stars. In the center were the last lights of Fort Beulah, far below, and on the left, unseen, the soft meadows, the old farmhouses, the great dairy barns of the Ethan Mowing. It was a kind country, cool and clear as a shaft of light, and, he meditated, he loved it more every quiet year of his freedom from city towers and city clamor. One of the few times when Mrs. Candy, their housekeeper, was permitted to enter his hermit's cell was to leave there on the long table his mail. He picked it up and started to read briskly, standing by the table. Time to go to bed. Too much chatter and belly aching this evening. Good Lord, past midnight. He sighed then and sat in his Windsor chair, leaning his elbows on the table and studiously reading the first letter over again. It was from Victor Loveland, one of the younger, more international-minded teachers in Doremus's old school, Isaiah College. Dear Dr. Jessup. Dr. Jessup. Not me, my lad. The only honorary degree I'll ever get'll be Master in Veterinary Surgery or Laureate in Embalming. A very dangerous situation has arisen here at Isaiah, and those of us who are trying to advocate something like integrity and modernity are seriously worried. Not probably that we need to be long, as we shall probably all get fired. Where 2 years ago most of our students just laughed at any idea of military drilling, they have gone warlike in a big way, with undergrads drilling with rifles, machine guns, and cute little blueprints of tanks and planes all over the place. 2 of them, voluntarily, are going down to Rutland every week to take training in flying, avowedly to get ready for wartime aviation. When I cautiously ask them what the dickens war they are preparing for, they just scratch and indicate they don't care much so long as they can get a chance to show what virile, proud gents they are. Well, we've got used to that, but just this afternoon, the newspapers haven't got this yet, the Board of Trustees, including Mr. Francis Tasbro and our president, Dr. Owen Peasley, met and voted a resolution that, now listen to this, will you, Dr. Jessup? Any member of the faculty or student body of Isaiah, who shall in any way publicly or privately, in print, writing, or by the spoken word, adversely criticize military training at or by Isaiah College or in any other institution of learning in the United States, or by the state militias, federal forces, or other officially recognized military organizations in this country, shall be liable to immediate dismissal from this college, and any student who shall, with full and proper proof, bring to the attention of the president or any trustee of the college such malign criticism by any person whatever connected in any way with the institution, shall receive extra credits in his course in military training, such credits to apply to the number of credits necessary for graduation. What can we do with such fast-exploding fascism? Victor Loveland. And Loveland, teacher of Greek, Latin, and Sanskrit, two lone students, had never till now meddled in any politics of more recent date than AD 180. "So, Frank was there at trustees' meeting and didn't dare tell me," Doremus sighed. "Encouraging them to become spies. Gestapo. Oh, my dear Frank, this is a serious time. You, my good bonehead, for once you said it. President Owen J. Peasley, the bagged-faced, pious, racketeering, damned hedge schoolmaster. But what can I do? Oh, write another editorial, viewing with alarm, I suppose." He plumped into a deep chair and sat fidgeting like a bright-eyed, apprehensive little bird. On the door was a tearing sound, imperious, demanding. He opened to admit Foolish, the family dog. Foolish was a reliable combination of English setter, Airedale, cocker spaniel, wistful doe, and rearing hyena. He gave one abrupt snort of welcome and nuzzled his brown satin head against Doremus's knee. His bark awakened the canary under the absurd old blue sweater that covered its cage, and it automatically caroled that it was noon, summer noon, among the pear trees in the green Harts Hills, none of which was true. But the bird's trilling, the dependable presence of Foolish, comforted Doremus, made military drill and belching politicians seem unimportant, and in security he dropped asleep in the worn brown leather chair. Chapter 4.